Welcome back to Work in Programming. This week, I am joined by Kati Kraman.
Hello.
From Formidable Labs, I believe.
Yeah, that's correct.
Would you like to do a quick introduction of yourself?
Yeah, sure. Well, like you said, my name is Kati. I live in London, and I currently work in a JavaScript consultancy called Formidable, where I'm a senior software engineer and an engineering manager.
Okay. And then I guess in that case, the work that you do is kind of split between like managing the teams as well as actively developing?
Yep. Yeah, exactly. I think it's, so we're a bit unique in the way that we do management. So All of our engineering managers are software engineers and are, you know, work on projects. So it's maybe like a 80-20 split. So 80% of the time they're still working and doing technical work.
Cool. Do you find that is stressful, or do you think that split's really, you like that split?
So I personally like that split. I think I feel like it's a fear of a lot of engineers when going up the career path and going into management, that you become the manager and then you stop being technical. And I think that as Winnebago is a very, very technical company and we love tech, all of us, it's kind of a concern that a lot of us have had. So for me personally, this works really well. So you do have to learn to balance things. Like, for example, you end up having more meetings. You need to learn how to manage your time and like put meetings, like clump them together and all these kind of tricks. But yeah, I think it's good. It works for me.
Cool. And then what sort of work does Formidable work on? I know that you do React development.
Yeah, so it's pretty much anything in JavaScript, or well, TypeScript these days, but you know, almost the same thing. So we do React, React Native, Node.js, and in terms of infrastructure, we tend to do anything AWS, but I've worked on Google Cloud as well, so we're pretty platform agnostic when it comes to infrastructure.
Cool. And then I'm looking at your website right now, and it seems like you're working with a lot of like big name US companies, which is interesting. Is the company based out of the US?
Yeah, so the head office is actually in Seattle. So we have four offices now. There's Seattle, Denver, Phoenix. Oh, I forgot, Toronto just opened.
Cool.
And London. So London's like the first and currently, well, not only anymore, but the first non-US office. So we just opened Toronto like a couple of weeks ago. It was actually just before the pandemic. So we're currently hiring in Toronto.
Oh, cool. Yeah. How has, I mean, obviously you're in London, so you haven't been necessarily as directly involved, but how do you think that, I guess COVID must have really impacted the growth, eh?
Yeah. So obviously, as we're a consultancy, so we are dependent on people hiring us for work. So when COVID hit, we did have a hiring freeze for about like a month and a half. And we've recently, like a couple of weeks ago, we started hiring in Toronto again. So we're going to start ramping it up.
Very cool. Yeah, I've noticed that it's surprising, but like, I work in an agency as well. And it's actually quite surprising, like how many new projects are coming in despite like the current situation, which is, it's nice. It's at least, job security for now.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually interesting. So for big companies, like companies that can afford this kind of hiatus, it's actually, you could argue it's actually a good time for them to invest more in consultancies and in tech, so that when COVID lifts, they'll be ready with some new stuff. Whereas obviously it's much, much harder for smaller companies.
Definitely. Yeah, I think it's gonna, I mean, it's definitely changing the landscape a lot, which is sad, but I keep hearing something about like the idea is like if you have like decades where it feels like only a few weeks really pass, and then like you have weeks where like a decade passes in a week, and it feels like that's just happening constantly now.
Yeah, like, I mean, I've got to say, I feel like 2020 has been going on for at least a decade.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, but I guess that all that aside, so I was curious. So how did you get into development in the first place? Did you go to like a university traditional route or?
So I did go to university, but I actually studied mathematics.
Okay.
And so the first bit of programming I did was in second year of my maths course, mm-hmm. where we had a C++ module. Mm-hmm. And I remember it was quite funny. It was two semesters. And on the first semester, we actually learned about programming and memory management, but mm-hmm. in a classroom. So it wasn't until the end of the first semester that we actually got to go to the computer room and actually like write some physical code.
Oh,
and I remember
wow.
that so well. Yeah, it was very like theory first learning how to program. And I remember thinking like, Jesus, it's so easy. Can't we just like get into it and start coding? But yeah, when I actually like wrote my first C++ program and it compiled, it was magical. but yeah, so after that, actually, I went to University of Birmingham and they have this scheme where you can, if you're a non-computer science student, mm-hmm. you can do a year of computer science in between your second and your last year. So I was in a three-year degree, but I chose to do an extra year of computer science as my third year, so I ended up being in a four-year degree. So that's where I learned a little bit more about like classical computer science. Mm-hmm. You know, Java, SVN, all the fun stuff I definitely still use.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I guess if you're doing React Native, you might play around with Java once in a while, right?
Yeah, hilariously, it did end up like coming back to me. I didn't think I would ever write Java again after university. but yeah, after university, I basically ended up working at a scientific programming company called Tesla. And basically they hire only physicists and mathematicians and kind of work on projects that are like tech plus science for various pharmaceutical companies and space and defense and that kind of stuff. So there I actually started doing .NET and Python. Mm-hmm. And so until then I hadn't done any JavaScript. Mm. And I was on a project where I had to do a data visualization kind of website for a pharmaceutical company. Mm-hmm. And this is where I started kind of looking into front-end JavaScript.
Okay.
And that kind of led me to Angular 1. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, well, this front-end stuff is cool, but Angular is a bit crazy.
Yeah.
And that kind of led me to React and to London and, well, the rest is history.
Cool. And so you weren't in London initially. You moved there for work, I guess?
Yeah, so I moved here for React. So my first React job was London. Before that, I was, the office I was in was based just outside of London.
Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And then I guess with React, what did you find to be like with your journey? Like, because I guess like going from back end development to like front end development is, I found it to be a pretty odd change, like a big change. Like, I started off as like web development, but most of my work was like backend and like it was still JavaScript, which is really convenient. But I didn't get to do like heavy front-end development until a few years in. Like most of my work wasn't really, I guess, design heavy. Do you find that like your back-end development and like all of that kind of experience builds into the way you deal with front-end? And like, how'd you find that journey?
Interesting. So I found the less the API knowledge and more the like infrastructure knowledge quite interesting. Because when like some of the projects that I did, like depending on the company as well, because now we have, you know, AWS or even like things like Heroku and Next and well, what's Zeit now called again?
Oh, Vercel.
Yeah, I can't pronounce that. yeah, so we have all these services to like kind of deploy your websites and like handle URLs and all that kind of stuff. Whereas I had to, once for a client, like they wanted me to host a website. Mm-hmm. And I was like, all right, cool, well, where do I host it? And they pointed at the machine and they were like, over there, please. So I had to figure out the, like, I had to get SSH credentials to that physical machine. I had to, install a server. I had to, like, fiddle around with IP tables to actually expose the correct port. Like I had to install Nginx. I had to configure IP tables. I had to, like, manually, like, SSH in there to actually deploy my website.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of knowledge that I'm really grateful that I have, because I feel like if I started learning to code now with all the resources that we have, I don't think I would ever bother to kind of, like, start from that low of a level.
Yeah, it's almost like it wasn't a choice. you kind of had to. Yeah, I found that bash scripting and things like that, like trying to automate, like, deployments on, like, a physical server, or, like, I was always in, like, the VM world, so I got very lucky with that, but I still had the chance to work with those sorts of, like, I guess, like, scripting out and, like, deploying things, like, manually, and I found that it built very well into, like, automation. So, like, if you're doing CI/CD and things like that, it's almost like you're doing, like, the stages, right? You're doing everything manually first, and then you're like, oh, this is so annoying. It's so hard to, like, keep everything consistent. Like, if you forget one step, your whole system goes down, I guess.
Yep. Yeah. No, we have it. Yeah. It's good times for, like, in terms of tooling. I think we're in a very good place now.
And what would be your go-to stack right now? Like, if you were to start a project brand new, and let's assume, actually, do you do a lot of brownfield work or more so greenfield?
I mean, we do both. Mm-hmm. I think so. My current project was greenfield. Is greenfield. Well, I guess was, because I built stuff now, so it's brownfield for anyone joining. but the previous project for the same client was brownfield. Okay. So for me personally, it's like 50-50.
Okay, cool. And then, so, like, if you're starting off a new project, what is your, like, go-to kind of stack and setup?
Am I doing web or React Native?
Oh, good point. Let's say web to keep things. Actually, I'm curious about either. Like, what would you do differently between React Native and web?
So it really depends on the project, I think. Mm-hmm. So in general, because I'm very much in the JavaScript world, I would use JavaScript, or rather, I guess nowadays I would use TypeScript.
Right.
So JavaScript with types. I think there was a choice before between Flow and TypeScript, but the TypeScript community seems to be way ahead. So now most of our projects are in TypeScript.
Yeah, the jump to TypeScript seemed like pretty sudden. Like, I remember, like, hearing about it and everyone was talking about it, and then, like, Microsoft was behind it, so, like, I was kind of skeptical. And then now, like, I don't think I would take on a new project without, like, adding TypeScript to it.
Yeah, exactly. So in terms of the API, I would use, you know, Node.js Express. Mm-hmm. I would use GraphQL if the client was up for it, with like Apollo Server. In terms of, like, where to host it, usually for us, it would be like wherever the client kind of wants it. Ideally, like, I like doing, like, serverless functions. Like, oh, I like to deploy the API as a serverless function. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, it's not, like, persisting all the time. That works quite well.
Yeah.
And all the, like, major providers, give you a way to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that builds pretty well into, like, the way that, like, people are moving towards, like, Vercel, for instance, where you have, like, the whole system as just serverless functions and it automatically deploys and.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, I think if I could choose anything, I would probably use, I still want to say Zeitnow, Vercel now. I could use that because it's so easy. Yeah. I deployed something recent, I think.
Hmm.
Was it Netlify?
Netlify is great as well.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, it would be a choice between them. Realistically, if I'm on a client project, usually there'll be, like, they'll have their own AWS cluster, so they'll want to use that or Google Cloud. Mm-hmm. And in terms of front end, I guess, so on the React Native side, the choice is basically plain React Native or Expo.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, begrudgingly coming towards the conclusion that Expo deserves another chance. When I first started working with React Native, that was like over two years ago, we did use Expo, and it was really early days. And then injecting was an absolute nightmare, and we had so many problems. And then after that, I've pretty much gone plain React Native.
Yeah.
But now with like everything, all the improvements that they've had, all the like integrations, and like the easy way it is to, it's possible to step away from Ecto now. Mm-hmm. I would probably go with Expo.
Cool. Okay, that's interesting. So like I've never actually used Expo itself. I did React Native a while ago, and I like the framework in general. Like, just it makes it so great to just be able to build for both, and like, you know, just to be able to like use this familiar technologies, but. Expo was, I remember seeing it and I thought it was just a UI kit when I first saw it, and I had no idea like what the use case for it was, but I guess so it must be a lot better now, I guess.
Yeah, there's a lot to it. I mean, I always use it when teaching React Native, just because it's so much easier to get started, and it's also cross-platform, so it doesn't matter if you're on a Mac or on a Windows machine or on a Linux, you can build an Expo project and run it on your physical device, which, okay, for example, you can't do if you have an iOS device and a Windows laptop. So for that reason, like, it's really, really handy. But also they have a lot of modules that they've customized, and like that they've brought together. They have like their debug tools, like they have people actually, you know, paid to make Expo better day after day after day. Whereas with React Native, obviously, it's, you know, there's a React Native team, like in Facebook, and there's community contributions, but, you know, it's kind of a different kind of level. They kind of care about their internal usage of React Native, maybe more, or like, you know, they have to balance it between internal usage and like the open source usage. Whereas for Expo, like, they have an interest in getting customers to like use Expo like on top of React Native. So they put a lot of effort into like making a more seamless user experience. So like there's a lot of features in there that you get out of the box that you might have to like struggle and, you know, kick and scream and Google if you're doing plain React Native. Like saying that, I will have to say that all of the client projects that I've done in React Native have been using plain React Native. So I think like next one, I'm likely to recommend Expo, but currently I've been plain React Native.
Okay, cool. Oh, so it wasn't that you would avoid Expo intentionally. Well, prior to this, you were avoiding it because of the issues that you mentioned before. And then now you'd actually go back to it. Like, do you think that you'd still have to eject it? Probably.
So you don't actually have to, I would consider not starting with Expo in it, but just using the like Expo module that provides some of the like functionality, because most projects do need ejecting, because it's, for example, if you add like specific authentication, or if you have like your own payment provider, if you do any kind of native module, you need to eject. And like pretty much any kind of non-MVP project ends up in that state.
Right.
So you kind of have to prepare from that from day one.
But you can still use like the Expo modules in a plain React Native app now.
Yes. Yeah. That's a recent change by them. I haven't personally like given it, like I can't really vouch for it because I haven't personally like tried it out on a project, but everyone who has have been quite positive about it. So.
Awesome. Cool. I'll have to try out Expo next time then. And then, so the way that I had discovered you is through your front end master's course. Like I thought it was cool because like the front end master's content tends to be like very, I think it's like beginner friendly. But like I find it useful, like even just like going over like things that I've already worked with, or like I did one on like design systems recently, which, you know, I'm not a designer. So it's like, it's really fun to like learn how like someone who's worked on like large scale design systems approaches it. And like, I really enjoyed the content in your course. I was curious kind of like how that process went about. Cause I think teaching something in a way that like beginners and like more intermediate advanced folks can understand, it seems like it's a difficult balancing act. But also like just creating a course in general, I'm very curious about it. Like, how did you go about that?
So when I found out that I was going to be running that course, the first thing I did was basically, I've got this whiteboard at home, mm-hmm. and I wrote down like all the things that in an ideal world I'd like to cover. So I was thinking back to the apps that I've built in the past, mm-hmm. and kind of the core components that I needed there. And specifically, I was thinking when I myself transitioned from writing primarily React to writing primarily React Native, like what were the things that I kind of, you know, the gotchas that I had where I was like, oh, I didn't realize that. So like I made a mistake and then, you know, recovered from it. So kind of those were the things that I wanted to cover. Mm-hmm. And then, well, then it was basically a process of elimination because the whiteboard was full and I only had a 1-day workshop. Right. So that was basically the start. So I had to cut like half of it to a point that I think potentially we'll do an advanced course to cover like all the cool stuff that we didn't get to, because this was meant to be a course for basics. So there was already a course on React Native, but it was like 3 years old. So the and it was kind of interlaced with very much with Redux. So this was meant to be a beginner's course, but with the latest kind of React Native features.
Okay.
And then after that, from balancing so that both beginners and more advanced students would find it useful, the main thing that I did was at the end of every single code step, I've got a GitHub repository that has a commit with a diff of like exactly that step. Basically so that if you're a bit less experienced and you get stuck, there's always like an exact like point we can pick back up. Because the worst thing was like, what I wanted to avoid is for anyone to like get stuck and then get frustrated and not being able to follow the rest of the course. Mm-hmm. So that was basically the main tool.
That makes a lot of sense. And I guess, yeah, so you've got like a separate, you've kind of got a flow that just goes through all the individual steps. Okay, cool. And then I was going to ask about the format, because I noticed that the front end master's courses that like you're talking in front of a crowd. But I wasn't sure if that was like a personal choice or if that was like the format that they always go with. I guess that's what they always use, right?
Yeah. So as far as I know, that's what they use. So the way the workshops work is, well, I guess nowadays you can't physically go there anymore,
right.
But, you go to Minnesota, to Minneapolis, to their offices, and, they have this like office, it's a really nice building, and it's set up with like a desk with like a proper camera, like a proper lighting and, like this podium. Mm-hmm. And basically you have, about 15 people, like 10 to 15 people who are live, like during the workshop. And the purpose of that is, you know, obviously you get some cool shots, mm-hmm. you know, a bit of snazzy video, but also just to have like a live audience to engage with, because it really helps to actually see people's faces. I think that's the way they do it. I mean, that's, I find it helpful. Mm-hmm. And then you also have a live audience. So anyone, I think you might have to be a subscriber of Frontend Masters, but you can join online during the workshop day and just watch the live video. Mm-hmm. And there's also like a chat on the website. So if anyone joining remotely, if they have any questions, they can ask in the chat, and then they have someone like keep an eye on the chat and then basically call out any questions if they're repeating. So the purpose of that is that basically you get the workshop experience, but also if there's like common like questions or comments that people have, like I could answer them on camera, and then you can incorporate that into the course like during the editing phase.
That's an interesting format. I can imagine that would be like anxiety inducing though.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a little bit. Yeah, I mean, like, I'm not the most comfortable person in the world in front of a camera. It's I know some people love it, and you know, that's why they have a career in acting, and this is why I'm in software.
have you done, I mean, obviously at your role, you probably do these sorts of talks with your employees, but have you done these sorts of like public workshops before?
Yeah, I have. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I've done, like, I've helped out in workshops during, like before conferences. And I think most recently I did a React Native workshop in Bulgaria. I think it was like end of last year. The content was completely different. We built a like a live chat app because that was really like a two-hour workshop.
Right.
But yeah, I think like, so in a consultancy role, you kind of end up in a like teaching / mentoring role quite often. Like it's usually less formal, so it's usually less, you know, one person standing in front of a like a room of people, although it does happen sometimes.
Yeah.
But, you know, companies hire us like to be the experts, so it's our job to kind of keep ahead of the whatever trends and there are, and kind of you know, help out, instruct, mentor, teach.
Yeah, definitely. And then do you teach so do you do these workshops with clients in the same sort of sense, or is it more like, I guess that would be more so, I guess you're the expert, you're the consultant in the room, so they're going to ask you about the project, or you're going to come up with solutions and things like that on the spot, I guess.
So I personally haven't done a workshop like this with clients, although that is a service that we as Formidable offer, and I know that we have done it with other clients.
Okay. How did you actually get started with React Native?
Well, yeah, so that's a fun story, actually. So I had been building stuff with React for about 2 years, and I was like really into the React community. I went to like all the meetups. I, you know, this was before hooks were launched, so I felt like I knew everything there is to know about React.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was quite fun, but it kind of got a bit samey. So I was like, you know, when you get a design, you build a component, you know, it's, you know, you just know, like when you know exactly what to do, it gets a bit boring.
Yeah.
Although now hooks came along, so now everything's exciting again. but yeah, at the time I decided to change jobs and I joined this startup. Actually the only startup I ever worked for, and it was quite fun. It definitely got the startup experience. I was there for about 8 months, and I swear it was the most code I have like ever written in my life. So basically it was a startup called well, they're still going, but they're called Rota. Okay. And they're basically like Uber for waiting staff. So if you're a hotel or a bar or some kind of venue and you need some extra temp staff, for example, you want to like someone to come in from like 6 p.m. to 12, then you would like post the shift on this app, and then people who'd subscribe to us could see the shift. They could like say, yes, I'm coming. And then they show up, do the shift, and then we kind of pay them. And that's basically the whole thing. And then when I joined, they were already going for like 2 years, I think. And they wanted to do a revamp of their entire platform. So when I joined, they were just starting it. And I joined a team of two other people, so the two other senior engineers. So there was three of us. And within about, was it 3 or 4 months, we completely rebuilt their entire platform. This consisted of a website, an API, like very complex logic on the database side, and a React Native app. And none of us three were really very, very well versed in any mobile development. I don't think any of us had really built a mobile app before, except for one guy. I think he'd done something, but none of us could do like any native Android or iOS stuff. So React Native, right, even though it was super new at the time, was like the only way to go anyway. And that's the part where we actually used Expo. And I think we had like 3 or so months for the whole project. And we had 2 weeks to go before we needed to launch. And we were like, all right, it's time to start working on the app.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty much, it's amazing that it got out the door.
Yeah. Did the app have like the full functionality of the website?
No, so actually the way it worked is that, and things still works, is that the website is for the people posting the shifts, like for the bars and hotels, and then the app is for people working the shifts.
Yeah. So that makes sense.
Yeah, so they're for different purposes. Yeah, it was a very turbulent experience. So yeah. it was very much, you know, no easing into it. But I think React Native was like a perfect fit for this situation. And all of us were pretty good at React already. So like the skills were very much transferable, except for, you know, all the native deployment magic with Apple.
Yeah. Yeah. Getting it out the door is like almost because it. So the way that I started with React Native was I was working with a startup kind of like as a freelancer and we were rebuilding some of their back end systems and everything. And then I was lucky. I had like at least a couple of months to build the React Native app. So I didn't end up in that situation. Like 2 weeks is pretty insane. I have to say, I can't even imagine like it's an impressive effort. But I've met a lot of folks that have tried working with React Native, and a lot of them complain about all these, just a lot of issues, I guess, with the framework itself. But what I ended up finding was like, I maybe it was just the type of app that I was building. But it seemed like it was pretty seamless. You know, you're building UI. So if you're just building UI, then it's just React. And, you know, I guess the native integration is definitely where difficult stuff comes in. And I think, because if you're just doing like network requests and then UI, then it's easy. And then I haven't had to delve too far outside of that realm yet. So I guess I've been lucky that way. Did you find that there were any like major like hiccups with the native integrations and stuff? Like any, I guess, because if you're doing, you know, like, I guess like free, like not freelancer, but the contractor, like check-ins and stuff like that, were you handling like payments and stuff as well, or?
So not payments on that app.
Right.
Because it was via bank transfer. So the users would put their bank details in. It was a while ago, I don't quite remember, but like it was definitely not through the app. But in terms of the native integrations, actually the benefits of like one of the reasons React Native is so awesome is that you can do anything in React Native that you can do in native, right? Especially if you can write in Swift or Objective-C or I guess Java and Kotlin. Because it is infinitely extensible. So I wrote a security library for React Native, which bridges existing iOS and Android libraries that do OAuth. So basically, the only code that I wrote was the Objective-C and the Java bridge on the platforms that basically just pass through. Well, they did a little bit more than that, but basically they pass through the commands and then just call the native code.
Right.
And that was, because then, if you're a JavaScript developer, but a React Native developer, and you don't really want to mess with all the like native stuff, all you can do is like you install that library and just call the JavaScript API.
Oh, cool. Yeah, and did you open source that?
Yeah, it's called React Native App Auth. Bit of a mouthful.
React Native App Auth, cool. I'm curious about that then. Have you done other open source software contributions? Like, have you worked on a lot of different open source libraries at all?
So not a huge amount. I do tend to, I'm very conscious that the JavaScript community is built on open source. Like everything that we use every day is like open source, and it's because of like sometimes companies, but a lot of the time it's because of individuals like contributions. Like they spend their spare time doing this, and I'm incredibly grateful. So I've always been conscious like of wanting to give back. So the first open source library I actually did is called DraftJS MD Converter, which was, well, it is what it sounds. So there's a rich text editor from Facebook called DraftJS, and it outputs text in these like DraftJS blocks. And basically I needed that to be marked down. This was for work at some point. And I wrote this little utility function. And then once it was done, I was like, oh, cool. This is like a standalone thing. I could open source that. So like I rewrote it a little bit and open sourced it. That was like the first open source library that I did. And it just feels good. It feels good to give back to the community. It makes me really happy. But also like in day-to-day work as well. So because I do use, well, we do use open source so much. Mm-hmm. If I find a problem, like a niche thing that like happens in a library, mm-hmm. Like being an open source maintainer myself, I will try to act the way I wish, I guess, my users would act, mm-hmm. which is I will try to fix it. So rather than like creating it, like unless I don't know what the issue is, like I'll try to figure out what the issue is, and I'll try to make a PR to fix that issue, like whenever possible. So I've done quite a few, like over the years, I've done quite a few like small contributions to libraries, just like either adding enhancements or like adding like tiny features. Those are the only two libraries that I've maintained. I actually recently I wrote a blog post around how to publish open source NPM packages. Just to give some like the basic commands. It gets a bit tricky if you want to publish like a release candidate. I don't know if you've ever done that before.
I haven't ever released an NPM package. So I'd be curious, like how does that work? Like what's the what's involved? Obviously not to make you repeat your blog article, but I've got the blog article open here now, but I mean, sorry, I lost my train of thought there.
So how do you publish a NPM package?
Yeah, I guess what are like the trickiest parts, or you mentioned that the release candidate is.
Yeah, that's the release candidate is the scary part. But basically, there are like package registries, and NPM has this like one centralized one, and that's where, you know, usually that's where React is, that's where React Native is. You can have your own like personal one. There are tools where you can like launch your own package registry in AWS. GitHub has one. You can have like a private NPM, so you can launch, like you can publish it in loads of different places. Mm-hmm. But by default, you would publish it to the public NPM package registry. Mm-hmm. And I mean, generally, like, if you start a JavaScript project, you have a package JSON, and if you're doing like a client project or a personal project or anything that's not open source, you would do like private is true. There's like a key in the JSON that says private, and it should be true. Mm-hmm. And that's so that you wouldn't accidentally publish it, which I always find that would be the worst thing in the world, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Whoops, here's my client project.
Yeah. I've never done that, but I'll have to go make sure that
that's definitely a pro tip. Make sure that it's especially like if you do like any kind of like open source and you do publish packages, like it's so easy to just press the up key on a terminal and like accidentally do stuff like that. So yeah, that's a pro tip. Always private true in the package JSON if it's not open source.
Very cool.
In terms of publishing, like technically all you do is you do npm login to log in with your npm credentials and then you do npm publish. Like technically that's it. But there are some nuances around like what gets published, like if you want to restrict like which files get published, you have a build step, you have to do separate things. And like with release candidates, basically If you publish like a release candidate of your library, what you want is if someone npm installs your library, they will get the stable version. Whereas if someone does npm install my library at next or at like, you know, some kind of tag, they'll get this like special version that might be like alpha or beta or release candidate. Yeah, so if you want details on that, read my blog. It's on Dev2.
Cool. I'll link to it actually in the podcast notes.
Awesome.
And I guess do you contribute a lot of do you do a lot of blog posting and things like that?
Like, not a lot. I did actually made a New Year's resolution to write 12 blogs this year.
Whoa.
And halfway through the year, and I've done 2.
To be fair, though, I mean, it's 2 more than most people do in their entire career. Like, I don't know. Like, writing is very hard.
Yeah, I mean, it can be. And it's also, I feel like, so I end up, like, proofreading my stuff quite a lot. So the other blog post I wrote was about how to do a animated draw in React Native. Mm-hmm. And then for that, it took me like maybe 5 hours to write, like in an evening.
Mm-hmm.
And most of it was actually around like getting the code right and like getting the like screenshots and all that kind of stuff. I feel like it's, you know, once you get an idea and you get the motivation, you just sit down and you just write everything that comes to mind and
then
like go back and start editing it. I mean, that's how I wrote essays whenever I had to at school, and that's how I write blog posts.
My rule with essays was always have a deadline, which is whatever the teacher says, and then just do it the week before.
How did that work?
Pretty well, actually. I was always surprised that once I started writing it, I would just dump a lot of thoughts out. But it's one of those things where I think people who procrastinate sometimes, like, you might be procrastinating because you're thinking about it, you know? At least that's what I like to tell myself.
Yeah, no, I was procrastinating because I didn't want to do it. No, I've actually found that ever since I became an engineering manager, mm-hmm. at my job, I tend to do the things that I ask my reports to do. I tend to do them much earlier than I have to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes sense. It's kind of like, I don't know, if you have a review and you have to fill in a review form, or if you do any kind of like prep for a meeting or any kind of stuff, like, mm-hmm. I feel like I'm setting an example, which makes me like, without even thinking, like do things way before the deadline. Whereas I feel like if I wasn't like a manager, if I was in this position, I would be a last minute Larry.
Yeah. I kind of like that. That makes a lot of sense, where it's like, it's almost like you have to set an example now. So I guess you've just decided to become the person that it's cool. I think, do you think there's anything else that's changed a lot since you've become a manager?
I don't know, to be honest. Before just now, when I thought about it, I didn't realize I did that, but I think that is a change that was prompted by that. I think it's more like, I feel like there's more empathy as well. I think a lot more about what other people might be feeling and what they might be like, what they want.
Mm.
So, you know, cause you know, if you're an individual actor, you tend to, I guess, be a little bit more self-centered. Whereas now, because like a huge part of my role is to look after the best interest of like the people that I manage and make sure that they're happy and they get to work on the stuff that they want to work.
Mm-hmm.
Like I actually spend a lot of time thinking about that. And that also bleeds over into like outside of work as well. I find that I have a little bit more empathy just because it's kind of like a background thought all the time. I think, oh, you know, how might they be feeling? What will they want? Which I think it's like a nice thing. It's exhausting, but it's a nice thing.
Yeah. Did you find that is that a new thing for you then? Or did you always find that you were a bit more empathic?
I hope I was always a bit empathetic, but I think I'm more so now.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I'm just always curious because I always think about it as like, because I know a lot of engineers that end up becoming managers and they kind of hate it. And I find that like maybe it's just because like people that want to get into engineering don't always want to be managers, like people managers. But
yeah, I mean, people are complex, right? Mm. It's kind of like, as engineers, we kind of want to, like, we like facts, and I like facts, especially because of my maths background as well. Like, I like numbers and facts, and I like Boolean answers to questions, whereas people are not Boolean. People are, like, incredibly complex, and what is true about a person today might not be true anymore in a month's time. So they're also not immutable. So for that, it can be difficult, but it's also really, really rewarding if you do manage to do something good. Mm-hmm. But also, I feel like, so in consultancy especially, like, a huge part of our job is to be a technical expert in whatever field that we're in. And, you know, it's our job to keep in touch with what's going on in the tech that we're in, like in JavaScript world, and, like, be ahead of the curve compared to our clients, because that's what they're paying for. And, like, that's a huge part of it. But I find that in terms of, like, software projects, and in terms of consultancy especially, like, maybe 50% of the success of the project depends on people's skills. So it's, you know, connecting with the client, figuring out what they actually want, and also, like, interpreting, like, requests, especially if people tend to solutionize. And rather than saying, this is the problem we want to solve, they'll say, this is what we want. And then you have to, like, work backwards to figure out what they actually need to solve.
Right.
Like, that kind of stuff. So it kind of comes into your work. And I've pretty much, most of my career, except for the brief stint at a startup, I've worked at consultancies. So I feel like these are the types of skills that I've just, over the years, kind of collected. So maybe that does lead up to management, who knows?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think that, like, consulting, yeah, like, as a consultant, you have to, like, read between the lines a lot more and I guess communicate better, because the worst thing you can do is almost, like, just take verbatim what the client says they want and then just start doing it and then not even push back at all. And then, you know, it always ends up like, okay, you got scope creep, and then projects kind of become unwieldy, and they just grow and grow and grow, and the client's unhappy and the people are unhappy, and it can turn into a bit of a nightmare if you don't have those skills. So maybe, like, it's kind of,
yeah, but there's also an element of, like, even if you know that you know better than whoever you work for, like, you shouldn't ever go into a situation and then just, like, start acting like a know-it-all. Because I think there's actually a really good saying. It's people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Mm. Which actually I think really holds true, because it's basically, you know, ultimately the people that you work with are people, and you need to prove yourself to them before, you know, you can start putting advice on how to change things.
Definitely. I love that. I like that phrase. It's cool. Huh. And then I guess, okay, so that if in your job, you're probably mentoring a lot of, you know, junior engineers and whatnot, right? Or do you guys not hire new engineers as much?
So it's so. We don't have very many, like, very junior engineers. Mm-hmm. So even our juniors would be considered, like, mid-level developers, okay. I think. And it's just because of the way consultancy is, because, you know, we are meant to be experts. So it wouldn't be fair for us to hire, like, you know, people straight out of boot camps, which I don't think we do. In London, we definitely haven't. Mm-hmm. And that's just because of the nature of consultancy, because imagine if you were a client and, you know, you're hiring a consultancy with, you know, quite decent day rates, and then you get someone who's, you know, you've been coding for a year, and you'd probably not be very happy. So, like, yeah, because of that, like, I think even our juniors are actually mid-level developers.
Okay. So
there's definitely, like, there's, like, can be a skill disparity. But yeah, not a very big one.
Yeah, fair enough. I was, my question after that was going to be, like, and I guess it still applies. I mean, if somebody has a few years experience, they're still trying to, like, figure things out or learn and grow. Like, What do you tend to focus on early on, like with people?
In what way?
Oh, sorry. That's a good question, actually, because now that I'm thinking about it, that could be, it's totally unique to the person, I guess. But like, have you found that there's common problems that people tend to have? Let's say that somebody's coming from their first or second job and they're moving into consultancy, and, you know, just like common either mistakes or like things that they might be missing, that once they learn that, it kind of like helps them a lot. So I guess one of the examples is like, okay, testing, right? Like it just changes the way that you write and change code over time. Is there anything that you found that like has been one of those like 10x type things that you end up teaching people a lot?
So one thing that's interesting is people in the React community, like, you know, who are like the main people in the React community and like main consultancies, tend to write React in the same way. I'm not sure how to describe it, but like there's actually many ways to write React. Mm-hmm. But for example, at Formidable, I think all of us, like with very minor differences, would write, like if we were to like write a React component, we'd write it exactly the same way. Mm-hmm. So specifically, we would use like function components instead of classes. That was even before hooks, but like now that hooks are around, definitely hooks. Yeah. We would use hooks. You know, we would use TypeScript. If we had a choice, we would use single quotes. We'd probably use like trading commas. Although that's maybe a me thing. But you know what yeah. I mean. So like, there's definitely like a standard like way we write React, mm-hmm. and like that is actually different in different companies. And like that's one of the things that quite helps. I don't know like how it kind of arrived to this way of writing React. But it's kind of just happened. Maybe it's like if you do it for long enough, like that's the equilibrium you end up with.
Yeah. Like I remember starting out with React and I didn't understand that, you know, you should typically tend towards less state and more passing information down through props. And like, it's one of those, like, it's like things like that where you just pick it up over time. And I guess you kind of start doing that more. And then obviously as a result of that, you're like, oh, well, why am I writing all these class components? I could just write a functional component.
Yeah, exactly. And now that's, now that we have hooks, there's really no reason to write class components at all. Hmm. And that's kind of what people ended up with. And the other thing is that people tend to love functional programming. Yeah. I don't know if that's like, it's like just like some kind of selection bias, like based on being a JavaScript consultant, but people who are JavaScript consultants tend to love functional programming.
Yeah, I've definitely, I found that there's like a functional programming community that's like, you know, Haskell and things like that. And then there's like, you know, just functional programming, like the approach to like development. And I found that people that are in like that camp of like, oh, like I'm a functional programmer, like they look down on, so not like, I'm not as like a generalized statement. That's actually really, really, but like, it's like, it's almost like there's like a, we're not quite there. Sometimes I'm not entirely sure what the difference to some people is, but
like the to be honest, like I do know what you mean. So for a while I was really into Elm. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I've heard of it. I've never touched it.
Okay. Yeah, it's a very opinionated like functional programming language. And I went to an Elm meetup in London. I remember this really well because I was chatting to some of the people there, and people would ask like, oh, you know, so what do you do as your day job? Because, you know, obviously you're not writing Elm. And when I said that, like, I do JavaScript, honestly, the look of like scorn was palpable. I was like, Jesus, you would have thought that I'm doing something like selling my soul.
Yeah,
it's like, okay, so like, you know, the best, like if you could say that, you know, you actually work in Haskell or something or Elixir, like, then you're doing well for yourself. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's
not a whole lot of people that get the opportunity to work with those languages. So maybe once you do, you just never want to leave or something.
Yeah, exactly. And I can see that. But like functional programming is just very, like, I find it very satisfying. Mm-hmm. And I had a phase where I loved using Lodash FP,
mm-hmm.
Which is basically like, it's kind of like an extension of Lodash, where most Lodash function, you could, instead of like importing them from Lodash, you import them from Lodash/FP. And then what it does is like, it changes the argument order so that you could like curry the function, so that you pass whatever you are, like, for example, if you want to do an array, you pass the array at the very end, and then you can do like multiple like functions that this array goes through. So you could like add one to everything, you can filter it, you could like reduce it, like whatever.
Okay.
And I loved it. It's so satisfying. It looks so clean. It's like, it's so pretty. It was so satisfying to do that. And I spent maybe like 6 months being fully engrossed in it.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually I had to give it up, even though I still love it. And for the simple reason that unless you are also into functional programming, my code was quite difficult to decipher.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it was very gutting, because the fact of the matter is most people aren't into functional programming, especially like, you know, in a consultancy, you kind of have to adapt to whatever the client's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that when it came to kind of like me leaving and like someone inheriting my code and me talking through them through it,
mm-hmm.
We're quite confused by the functionalness of it.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately that's not beneficial to the clients or the other developers. So I went back to the old JavaScript way.
Yeah. I wonder if there's like a future where functional programming becomes like the traditional, like purist functional programming becomes more common in JavaScript. But yeah, I guess like the fact that you're importing the FP package from Lodash/FP instead of just plain Lodash, or like right out, like immediate Lodash, like the default imports, is kind of like indicative of that, right? It's like the fact that anyone who's going to import Lodash is going to by default import the non-functional version.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, saying that, I did use Lodash FP once last week.
Okay.
And it was because I had a single array that I had to do like several kind of like maps through it in order to get to the end array.
Mm-hmm.
And like otherwise in JavaScript, I'd have to keep doing like const, like new result equals array dot map,
mm-hmm.
Or whatever. And it was just like too many reassignments. So I did use pipe from Lodash and then do the find functions in there. But I added comments after every line. So I don't do it very often. I did talked it through with my team and they said it's fine.
Yeah. I guess if you keep it to like a certain area of the project, then it's like, you know, it's just beneficial at that point.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's about the team, right? So you talk to the team, and like, if they'd said like, no, I don't think it's a good idea, I wouldn't be offended. I'd go like, fair enough.
Yeah, I've met one team, or I've worked with one team that actually used functional programming for like the entire application that they were building.
Wow.
At my last role. And they were, it was kind of funny because that project was, you know, everyone who was on the project loved it and everyone was super excited about it. And they were like, oh, it's so clean. It's so fast. So great. But like anytime a new, engineer would join the team, they'd have to like train them on functional programming again.
Yeah. But then they join the cult and then,
yeah.
That's how we get the whole world on board.
Yeah, so we just need to start indoctrinating people into
using functional programming. Yeah.
Do you have any particular advice that if you were like approaching another developer or somebody who's getting into development, right? Maybe they went through a similar path as you. They did like a math degree or something outside of programming and then transitioned into computer science, and then they're going into the workforce, maybe it's their first or their second job. They're trying to really like, they want to like be able to get to the point where they can become the consultant and they can teach all these workshops and they can be the expert one day. What kind of advice would you give them to just make sure that, you know, their journey is the best it can be?
Yeah, so I mean, that's quite hard to answer because everyone's quite different. So one of the things is like to figure out what kind of a learner you are. Like, how do you learn? Mm. Are you the person who likes reading books? Do you like reading documentation? Like, do you like doing workshops? Are you a deadline driven developer? Like, I find that I actually, like, I work the best when I have like a deadline. Mm-hmm. And like something hard to do, you know, I just get my headphones in and like I figure it out, and like that's how I learn. And I like learning things by reading documentation, for example. So, you know, if I need to start a new thing, like I'd read the documentation. If it's open source, I might even read the source code, you know, and that's how I absorb information. But that might not be the case for everyone. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of figuring out how you absorb information and then learn based on that. So you can like read blog posts or watch workshops or, you know, Twitter, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Okay. I love that. Thank you. That's the first time I've heard that, advice. And that's really interesting. Cause yeah, it's like, I guess everyone does learn in a different way.
Mm. Yeah. And in terms of, like public speaking, I mean, it's not for everyone. Like, I find it, well, I still find it scary, even though I've done it quite a few times now, and it, you know, it never really stops being scary. But it's kind of, it's like a handy skill to have. So, if you were someone who wanted to go into doing workshops and doing public speaking, like the best way to do it is like start small. Mm-hmm. You know, so you do like a low risk thing. So I wouldn't recommend, you know, applying to like a big React conference that has thousands of people in attendance, and that would be your first talk, because that would be like that's a really high stress situation. Mm-hmm. So I would start off maybe, you know, a meetup, or even like if you work in a company, even just do a presentation to your colleagues in your company. There are people you know, so it would be like much lower stress than just a bunch of strangers, and then kind of progress into like more people. Mm-hmm. Which helps. And then, you know, depending on like how you feel, if you feel stressed or not, you can go for a bigger audience, and if you enjoy it, right? Because ultimately, if you don't like doing it, this, you know, you don't have to.
Definitely. Yeah. I guess it's not necessarily for everyone. How do you come up with, like, if you were to do that, how would you advise people come up with topics to talk about if they're going to do like a workshop for their company?
So the best topics are educational and things that relate to you. So the best thing to do, in my opinion, is just to think back to your experiences, to think back to, well, your work. Like, if your company or you personally have done something that you think not everyone has done, like, or if you've experienced like some kind of range of experiences that not everyone has done, because those kind of talks are interesting. Mm. Obviously, like if you're like really into some kind of open source and you publish like a new library, or you've got this like new way of doing things, that's always a good talk. Or if you, you know, it doesn't have to be like purely technical, it can be more people oriented. So if you have some kind of commentary on like workplace, like the way workplace should be run, like something around management, like how to write technical technical documentation. That was an amazing talk by Carolyn, I think. Like, you know, like it doesn't have to be like all about code. It could be about abstract thoughts and ideas, but ideally it should be relating to something that you've done, because that's the kind of topics that is easiest to talk about.
Cool. Yeah, I like that. Especially the idea of like just like picking something niche that not everyone, like something that you've done that not everyone would know, like writing technical documentation, which is most engineers' nightmare, having to document a system.
Yeah, but it's so important, right? Because like when you join a project, what is the first thing you do? You're going to read the README, and you'll be reading stuff, and it doesn't tell you how to launch the project.
Yeah, it's the worst. Like I've literally taken on entire projects where it's like, you know, a year's worth of a couple of engineers built it and there's no documentation whatsoever and you're just like, all right, what do I do?
Wow, good luck. It's like a puzzle. You're blindfolded.
Pretty much, yeah. Thank you so much for joining me, Caddy.
Thank you so much for having me, Matthew.